You're listening to Feeding the Mouth That Bites You with Ashley Parrish and Jessica Pfeiffer,
a weekly podcast guide on parenting teens and launching them into the world. As always, we are joined by psychologist and author, Dr. Ken Wilgus.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back. On today's episode, we will be discussing the addicted teenager and their family.
You know, Ashley, addiction turns a family upside down. Whether our listeners have a teen struggling with addiction, or they're walking alongside another family in this situation, or even if you've discovered that your teen is drinking or using drugs but may not yet be addicted, you will find some helpful information in this episode. To start out, I'd like to clarify with you, Dr. Ken, what exactly we're talking about being addicted to, because there are a lot of choices out there. There are drugs, alcohol, porn, video games, vaping. What are we talking about in this episode as far as addictions go?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's really two types of use of the word addiction. One is an addiction model that is a helpful way of understanding lots of compulsive and repetitive behavior, like pornography, workaholism, drugs, alcohol. But what we're going to talk about today is essentially what I would call real addiction, which is use of those substances that are intoxicants and you really do contribute to your body becoming more addicted and physically reliant on it. And there is a difference in that. So what I want to talk about today is drug and alcohol addiction, because that has some overlap with those other types, but man, it is a monster that can drag young people down. I think many people listening know, if it's not their family, they know a family that has one person or more that have really been just absorbed with the addictive behavior and the intoxication, and it just takes everyone down with them.
Now, I want to mention that in episode number 6, we did talk about vaping, drugs, and alcohol. So we will mention some of the things that we talked about then, but this is really more about the family unit and how to deal with the situation of addiction in your family.
Yeah. And it comes up more, even it's not surprising, during this time of pandemic. There have been even some famous people who have relapsed and so forth. When there's a large stress, then it makes it even more of an issue. Again, harder to know as a family and as parents, how do we respond to this?
Dr. Ken, there's a popular opinion that addiction is a disease. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think it's a disease process. It certainly is, in the more general sense, dis-ease. But since we talk about adolescence, and this is kind of going to be part of what we talk about, it is important to consider the behavior of the person and the responsibility of the individual who's addicted. So one of the obvious and important differences in disease model with addiction versus, say, cancer is that cancer is an external disease process going on in your body that you're not doing anything to continue it or to provoke it and so forth. But disease model using for addiction is going to involve someone that, at least physically, if you never drank this drink anymore or smoked this or took this drug, then all of the problematic aspects of this would go away. So you get the overlap when people exert their opinion about, well, they could stop if they want to. And that's where you get into, there are some people who are, I think, kind of ignorant that would say, you just stop. It's just, you can just do it with willpower. And I think that's, anyone that works with addiction knows that that's oversimplified. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's more popular. I think this is where your question comes from. It is now more popular today to describe addiction in a way that really does almost forget that the person that is doing the addiction behavior is exerting control and power over this, and they can and really must change their behavior or nothing will change. So it's also an extreme to say they are a passive, helpless participant. That, you know, marijuana does, every kid I've seen lately, no marijuana has snuck up and shoved themselves into their system and required it. These kids are, you know, obtaining it and using it and all that stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's separation, because if someone gets cancer, that wasn't voluntary.
That's correct. And even if something you did, you know, lung cancer because you smoked before,
right?
You know, there's a, think of it that way. Like if you continue to smoke, then, you know, that's not just the disease that's in your lungs. That's your behavior contributing.
Right.
So Dr. Kent, I bet you've seen a number of families with addicted teens. What percentage of them would you say that the both parents are in complete agreement about how to handle the situation?
That's interesting. I would say a relatively small percentage are in agreement, you know?
I would guess so.
You know, that gets into the, so one of the things we learned from Alcoholics Anonymous was that term enabling. And again, these terms get used to death so that they end up kind of not being as useful as they need to be. The real term for enabling was the almost surprising result that when long-term alcoholic, and back then it was usually men that were in AA, got sober, there was a not unusual result of their family fell apart or their marriage fell apart. And that was unexpected. Like, isn't this good? He's sober now. Well, it led to more the discovery that to be really long-term addicted, to maintain life where you are regularly intoxicated, it is quite common that there is, believe it or not, someone that is in fact kind of helping you to do that. Mm-hmm. Not you know, deliberately getting you intoxicated, but it requires very often someone else to take on a responsibility in this, in the addict's life, that in fact makes it, well, they enable their addiction. So in that case, then with teenagers, I've seen very commonly that one parent is really misunderstanding what role they should play and is deep into enabling. And usually the other parent is sort of overwhelmed and silent. Mm-hmm. I have had, you know, I don't know, maybe a quarter of them though, are both parents all about it. But it's mostly just one. What I've never, almost never had is one that is all about, in you know, enabling, and the other is strongly and regularly objecting and pushing back. I can't think of a time when that happened.
So Dr. Kim, let's talk about enabling for a minute. What are some reasons parents enable their kids?
Well, it's sort of like the reasons that anybody enables anybody, in that it's a really invisible thing that you do. Enabling is when, is not at all when you are secretly trying to help this person stay intoxicated. Not at all. There's no conscious desire to do that. It is, however, a significant misread of the boundaries of what am I responsible for in this person's life? What can I influence and what can I not? And what causes that is almost always a significant lack in some other area of this person's life. The enabler is not, for example, in a great marriage and just happens to be overstating all that they do with their kid. Virtually always, for parents who are enabling a teenager, there's something significantly, I guess I would say, unsatisfying in their relationship as a spouse, in other areas of life. And this, more than they're aware of, this provides a kind of purpose and goal and really an overstatement of what I can do in this young person's life. So it really comes out of a lack in other aspects of their life. And that's why it's so hidden and really not visible to the enabler.
But they don't really see it that way, though.
That's right.
I would assume that parents put it under the umbrella of love. I just love my kid so much. I don't want them to suffer. I don't want them to feel this pain. I don't want them to face those hard consequences like going to jail or something like that.
That's exactly right. And what's important for feeding the mouth parents is that they would recognize what you just said as a kind of a balance, because we have a lot of parents, not just with, you know, addiction, that give what they would say is love, but they are, without realizing it, not giving respect. And in this case, it's the same thing. Significant addiction, believe it or not, does not count as an exception to the planned emancipation schedule. a junior in high school who is struggling to do well in grades still needs to be left to their own management of it with some, you know, watching their grades, just like a junior in high school who is regularly intoxicated and continually getting in trouble with drugs. They're both still 18 months away from being done. It does not slow that time schedule down. And that's what's particularly important, is because just like you're talking about, with the kind of enabling sense, parents will absolutely, or the parent that is locked in an enabling kind of relationship will see this as unloving to continue to hold this young person accountable for their continued intoxication or drug use, alcohol use, that kind of thing. And that is only an extreme of what we already talk about when it comes to feeding the mouth and planned emancipation.
Well, I think as a parent, you might feel too, well, I'm not worried about his grades at this point because I'm just worried about him being sober and healthy. It just seems like I have bigger things to worry about here than,
yes,
right.
You know,
yes.
And also I think as a parent, you're trying to control maybe the things that you can. You want to keep them under your control and under your watchful eye as much as possible because one area is so out of control.
That's
so
really
as a parent,
true.
It's hard to let go of.
And it's one of the reasons, you know, if you spend time, you know, so I don't work primarily with addicted teenagers. If that's the primary thing, drugs or alcohol, that really is a kind of a group thing. You don't do that in individual therapy primarily. So, but as you can imagine, a significant number of teenagers that I work with, that is either eventually becomes the primary thing or it's part of what's going on. And if you watch that enough, that's part of why back in the drug and alcohol and vaping episode, it may have sounded pretty tough about a parent's stand about these things. But it's because these are intoxicants. And when you use anything that alters your consciousness, if you cross over into where I prefer that to sobriety, and I want to stay there all the time, which is kind of when addiction is, then it is just a life-altering, damaging, almost like a demon that just will not go away. Therefore, that's why, you know, vaping, that's not good. You need to remember, you're not a policeman, so we're not, how do I make sure they don't? You don't, but you put consequences for that. Drinking alcohol, not funny, much bigger deal. And marijuana, absolutely not funny. And vaping tobacco is not good. Vaping marijuana is an immediate felony. It is a huge deal. And so, you know, I can't emphasize enough that when your teenagers are dabbling with intoxicants, and make the separation in your own mind, nobody has crashed their car because they were smoking a cigarette. They didn't get out of control, but you can see on YouTube, I don't know why, but I watched something yesterday where these drunk adults were just stumbling down the stairs in the most out of control fashion. That's alcohol. That is drugs. And there's a current craze of trying to kind of talk about marijuana as a drug that sort of, quote, doesn't count. That's ridiculous. It is in some sense milder than some of the alcohol intoxication, but it is intoxication, and it will be there. Once you cross into addiction, you're at the risk of it will be a part of this person's life the rest of their life. And so you set the line pretty firm early. And when there's, you know, beginning to be a pattern, then you really have to intervene hard on trying to do what you can to set and make the consequence very unpleasant. Because once you're into that, the whole parental goal of I need to get my kid off this and help him to, or no, get him sober. You can't. It's like everything else. You can't make a teenager do these things. And it can be it can drain parents. I've seen it drain parents' entire savings to, quote, help. I've seen a teenage girl come home from 18 months of residential, I'm ranting here, 18 months of residential treatment for drug and alcohol. And she celebrated her coming home by getting drunk with a friend.
It's, oh my, like, goodness.
What in the world. So you have to know what you can and cannot control. And mm-hmm. you start before there's any kind of, you wink at this stuff and you do run a very big risk.
Right. Because I think what you're saying is without those clear limits and boundaries and consequences for your kid, that's when enabling comes into play.
Exactly.
And it's just so easy for things to get out of control. And mm-hmm. parents will justify in their mind, or maybe to their spouse, their actions of enabling, not
right.
realizing that it's enabling. So Dr. Ken, how do parents realize that they're in the midst of supporting their addicted teenager by enabling them?
That's easy. They virtually always don't recognize that.
They don't recognize
it. No, you'll see it. And listeners that know what I'm talking about, you'll know that if you have a friend or family member that is enabling, you know full well you can't walk in and go, hey, you ever heard of enabling? You're doing that. Not yeah. at all. It is an unconscious process. And the person that is in fact doing it really feels, when you point it out, number one, you won't be the first person that's done it. Oh, I've already heard that. But number two, what you'll hear is something on the order of, this is a much deeper thing than you really know. Because, you know, a parent can get super, you can read all kinds of stuff, super knowledgeable and really working at it. And you can find lots of professionals that are there to help. And those are all good things. Don't get me wrong. You know, offering treatment to a teenager that's willing to go, for example, is a great thing. But my concern is that when we look further into disease model, almost like when we talked about the teenage brain, especially with teenagers and young adults, parents must never forget that this teenager has their own responsibility in this, and they have to be held accountable, because you cannot do anything enough to make sure that they don't do these drugs anymore. That is an impossible game. And the parent that gets locked into that boundary problem of, I stay up late trying to think of how and who I can get to help me to keep my young adult child sober. Many listeners know just what I'm talking about. It sucks you in for years and thousands of dollars. And you have to recognize you cannot make someone not behave in their addiction if they really do not want to.
Okay, so the shame and embarrassment we feel as parents because our kid is struggling can keep us from opening up to other family members, maybe grandma and grandpa, or friends that care about us and care about our kids. It's easy to hide that from others, but it doesn't seem like that's the healthiest way to handle it. So how do we know who to tell and who to open up to about our situation at home?
Yeah, I would think that, you know, if your teenager has had an incident of getting caught drinking or, you know, a minor in possession charge with marijuana, you can use your own judgment about, is that dirty laundry necessary to tell everybody in my family? In the book, The Feeding the Mouth That Bites You book, we talk about that when something really big and bad has happened to your teenager, it's perfectly reasonable to recognize that it also happened to you. So if you, especially mothers, if you have an inner circle of friends that you tell the big things that happen in your life, it's perfectly reasonable and appropriate to tell them that, but you don't have to tell everybody. Mm-hmm. Once things move toward addiction, where we are really concerned that we have already had several incidents and he continues to secretly obtain and use and all that stuff, then in that case, again, you don't need to make a t-shirt out of it, but secretiveness can make that worse. It really grows in the dark. A side effect of all addicts is they get extremely good at lying. They just look you right in the face and lie. They get good at it because they're lying to themselves. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to enable that part by also being overly prideful parents who don't want to look bad and don't want anyone to know that my kid is going through this. That's mm-hmm. particularly true of Christian parents. Again, this is not all about you. This is about what we're going through. You know, addiction isn't just a parenting problem. Like if my kid is using drugs, it must be because I'm a bad parent. That's the sort of narcissism we work pretty hard to try to get away from. So overly secretive especially once it reaches a potential of addiction, can only make it worse. But a very early, you know, in an incident or two, I don't care if you tell a lot of people or not, that's not necessary. But once it gets to that level, the people that need to know, and no, I'm not going to help you keep this a secret.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Well, Dr. Ken, let's talk about marriages, because when parents have an addicted teenager, it can really destroy a couple's marriage. So I'm going to ask you kind of two different questions, and you can give us the longest winded question ever, because I just want to address it all for our listeners.
I'm feeling long winded today. So
Us. So here's my question about marriages. What do you see parents do wrong with their addicted teen that hurts their marriage? Kind of like what not to do.
Right.
And then give parents advice on how to get through it together, so at the end, they're still happily married and together.
So I kind of wrestled with, I could think of two couples this week on this issue, because the technically the addicted teen does not do great damage to your marriage. Okay. It can just as easily bring you together. The reason that it rarely does is because most of us marry based on some level of compatibility. I feel like we're kind of on the same page. And you will discover where you're not compatible in three major ways: money, children, and religion. Those are things that you just don't compromise easily on. So addiction is a pretty common example of when parents have that lack of ability to deal with real difference in how we think we should deal with stuff, and they don't know how to, they panic because we're not compatible in this, then it is one of the often the underlying weaknesses that keeps parents from doing what they need to do. You must be a united front, that we both are in the same boat here. And even if your mom isn't here, it's the same consequence when I'm here, those things. So a united front is critical. And so I would, I would just flip that a little bit, that problems with teenagers, with children, is commonly one of the ways you discover, wow, we don't know how to handle these incompatibilities, which, by the way, all marriages have. To just don't panic about it. It's just, how do I deal with how wrong you are about this thing? And your spouse is going, yeah, me too. You're so wrong about this thing. And you know how to deal with that. But marriages have to come together. So it actually starts by, if you do have a teenager that's increasingly going into addiction, you actually have to take the time to work on your unity as a couple and not forget that this isn't just a parenting problem. It displays that we do not know how to serve each other when we're both fearful of different things. So when parents are dealing with something as scary as drugs or alcohol, that's one of those times, I think we've talked about on the podcast before, that you need to know how to have those discussions that are, I will tell you what I'm fearing and you tell me what you fear, and we will take care of each other's fear. And a common one is one parent will say, essentially, I fear that if we come down too hard, it will push her away and only make her want to be more secretive. While the other parent will say, well, that's funny, because my concern is that we're too lax, and it only gives her the signal that she can and really wants to just get away with more. And I'm afraid that she's going to be out of control. And then, since we're married people, you switch fears and you take care of each other's fear. I don't want to do any kind of strict lockdown if it's going to cause my spouse to fear that it will push our teenager away. And that spouse will say, well, I don't want to cause you to worry about that we're too lax. You see what I'm saying? But that's marriage work first, and always monitoring how we take care of each other's heart while we're going through this. What mostly happens, and this is, I think, what I wrestled with twice this week, is no, it's not about marriage. I want to talk about parenting. What's the best parenting decision here? What should we do? And it's not that simple. It's not just, well, I found the book, because couples will find a book that says this and the other book seems to support that, but they're not taking care of their marriage. So you have to do that first.
Encourage those couples. What can you do as a couple, not as the parents, but as a couple, what can you do to get through this with your spouse?
Yeah, you have to first, as I mentioned, convince them that, okay, this is one of the signs of your inability to handle incompatibility. It is mm-hmm. not the cause of it. But mm-hmm. a lot of parents are pretty sure of it, that no, this jerk kid of ours, we didn't have, listen, Dr. Wilson, when we go off on a trip together, we do fine. Well, yeah, I could probably get along with anybody if I'm in paradise. I don't know. But it demonstrates a common weakness in marriage. So you start by recognizing that while we're trying to come together in this managing this teenager, and especially the complication of addiction and scary stuff, we have to use skills, work together, maybe even see a counselor on how to care for each other's fear, mm-hmm. because nothing is scarier. Well, there's something, this is among the scary things that really causes us to not feel okay with, okay, let's use your plan. Your plan is horrible and we're going to lose our child. Really? Well, your plan is no plan at all. You're just like your mother. And the next thing you know, you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're drowning each other.
Mm-hmm. I think that's super important in all areas of marriage, just to remember to care for each other's fears. I'm going to keep that in mind. That's good.
Easier said than done.
It is. It is. We're going to wrap it up right here. We have so much more to talk about. So we're going to continue on with a new episode next week.
Thanks for joining us today. Hit the subscribe button so you won't miss an episode. Also, leave us a review. This is how other listeners find our podcast. Follow us on Instagram at Feeding the Mouth.
We appreciate you and would love to hear from you. If you have any questions, thoughts, or ideas about what we've discussed today, please email us at podcast@feedingthemouth.com.
This episode sponsored by Marathon Sports. Running shoes online can feel like a guessing game, but Marathon Sports makes it easy to get the right gear without stepping into a store. At MarathonSports.com, you'll find the same trusted brands runners and walkers rely on, including Brooks, Hoka, New Balance, Asics, Saucony, and more. Whether you're training for a race, walking for fitness, or just need everyday comfort, Marathon Sports has the shoes, apparel, and accessories to keep you moving. Their online shop is built for athletes and everyday movers. Easy browsing, detailed product guidance, and fast shipping help you find exactly what you need without the hassle. Because the right gear doesn't just improve your run, it improves how you feel every day. Shop now at MarathonSports.com and get moving.